other interesting thing was that about once a month, every GSO2 had to take night duty officer, which meant at 5 o'clock he went over to the main famous Lutyens. We were in wooden huts, but we went over to the famous Lutyen building, and we were in a. You sat in a large room, which apparently was used every day by the top brass as a for planning meetings, with maps on the wall. And about every hour, a sergeant of signals would appear from the bowels of the earth with a box in which you had the key, and you'd open it, it was full of signals. And you'd go through those, and most of them were sit reps from the, because the operations in Burma were in full swing then. And every battalion every night had to send in a situation report, which he copied to GHQ. Mm-hmm. And so what you had to do with those was to get up on a pair of steps and look at this quarter inch map and trying to find some obscure Burmese village where these blokes were supposed to be fighting and put coloured flags in, pins in, and hope you were doing right. And then during the night you had to make up a sort of a comprehensive survey of the whole position to hand in the next morning. But apart from that, there were all sorts of other signals, and most of which you could say, well, they can wait, because being a training GSO2, I wasn't au fait with operational things, you see. Anyway, I remember there were two occasions a signal turned up, and I thought, well, this seems to me frightfully urgent. I'd better ring the CNC, Field Marshal All Connect. I sat there, I thought, well, shall I ring? I don't know. So I picked up the phone and got the operator to give me this number. And I'd met the Orc twice before, and I knew his voice. But when the phone, a voice said, yes, you know. I explained to him who I was and what was happening. He said, what the bloody hell do you want to wake me up in the middle of the night for that? Bang, you see, so I thought it was the last time I'm going to ring up the CNC. Another odd thing, one of the signals that I opened up, or I didn't open, when I got the envelope, it said, sacred. And I thought, well, I don't know, a confidential security thing called sacred.
Sacred, not secret.
No, sacred. I knew all about confidential, secret, and top secret, but I never heard of sacred. So we had lots of reference books in this room, so I found one and looked up sacred, and it said to be opened only by the person to whom it's addressed. And it was addressed to Auchinleck. So I thought, what the hell do I do with this? It was marked urgent. So I thought, well, after all, I am his representative, so I better open it. So I opened it. And it was it was a signal from Bill Slim, who was then the GOC Burma, saying in so many words, for heaven's sake, I want to get rid of some very senior officer. He's absolutely bloody useless. Recall him immediately and send me a good replacement, you see. So anyway, I put this back in the envelope and I never heard any more. But that was a... They could be very trying. You see, we've been doing a day's work. At 5 o'clock, you packed in at about 8.
Yeah.
You were then allowed a morning off. Mm. So you shot home to your mess, which was an old Maharaja's place in Delhi, which had been taken over.
So you were living quite well there, wasn't
it? Well, we were in huts in his garden,
yes,
you know,
yes.
And the food was not bad. But of course, the trouble was, it was, you know, May, June, July, bloody hot.
Yeah.
And we didn't go up to Simla in those days.
Yeah.
And we all travelled by bike. And to cycle down what is now the Raj Path at 12 o'clock and come back at 1 o'clock, I got prickly heat and boils and all sorts of things. But we were in these wooden huts. And of course, we had the usual fan. We had rush mats over the windows,
yes,
where every now and a beastie would come along and spray with water. But on our desks we had, I think they were called desert coolers. They were big boxes.
Water.
Yeah, with water put in the top, down through, with a fan at the back.
Yeah.
Well, of course, all these things made quite a noise.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to use the telephone, I mean, as I used to have to ring up Coconada or Mard Island, an immediate call you had to put through one day, and you probably were lucky if you got it the next day. And then the girl would ring up and say, your call's coming through. So then you'd have to rush around the room and switch off all the fans and the... And you'd sit there, and of course you'd sit there for 10 minutes, quarter of an hour while they were connecting you, and the perspiration would be dripping off the end of your nose. And
so you stayed on that in that posting really till the end of the war?
Yep, and then more, the BJ day, and then, so a pal of mine and I, we went off on our first leave, we went to Udaipur, Jaipur, Agra, and finished up in Nainital. And it's quite interesting because, of course, when we got to Udaipur, which is now famous as a holiday resort with those island palaces, we were the only two British people in the place. And we had to report to the resident and sign his book to say we were there. And on one occasion, one evening, we were walking down the side of the lake and we saw this procession coming along, this enormous black car and various other things. And it was the Maharaja. So we both stood to the thing and gave him a smart salute. And when he got down the past us, he stopped, and his entourage produced a bloody great chair, and he sat down and sat in his chair looking out. And on the other side of the lake, and it's still there, I suppose, every night, wild boar used to come down. They were fed, so they all came down. The idea was that if the old boy wanted to have a shoot at a wild boar, they would all be... They're waiting for him.
And then which Maharaja was this?
Oh, cool. He was pretty old in those days. This is, I don't know.
Maharaja.
Yeah. Then we went to Jaipur, and on the narrow gauge railway.
Yeah.
And then we went to Agra and saw the Taj, and we were on our own there, more or less. In fact, in those days, they allowed you to go up those minarets.
Really?
And we climbed up the minaret, and we came out onto one of those narrow things and took photographs.
Yes.
Then we went to Nainital, which was very nice. We had a week up there, and then we came back to Delhi. Then in November, the India office asked for my Class B release.
This was what? 45.
Yes, November 45. And so Sheila, who's now my wife, she was working in the air office, she gave me advance warning of this. And so when the official thing came through, I went into the Adjutant General branch and said, look, I know that Class B releases go home by sea, but as I haven't had Christmas at home since 1939, do you think you could fly me home? Oh no, you couldn't fly home. So I pulled weight and said, well, it's the Secretary of State for India, you know, India office. He's the big boy, he wants me. So they said, well, exceptionally, you can fly home, you see. So in due course, I got on a Dakota at Delhi, flew to Karachi, spent 10 days by the side of the airfield at Karachi because the ground crews of the RAF were on strike. Eventually I got a Dakota to Tel Aviv. On the way over, the pilot said I could come up and sit in the second pilot's seat, and he showed me all this, that and the other. We just had a weather forecast from the famous RAF station Shaiba, which you may have, there was the Shaiba Blues. And almost straight away, the engine started making the most horrible noises, so he said, back you go, get the other bloke up. So we went back, we landed at Shaiba, they repaired the plane, we took off, landed at Tel Aviv, in a tented encampment guarded by some 7 foot tall West African jet black troops who used to frighten the life out of us. I sang carols in the fields of Bethlehem on Christmas Eve. Eventually got a plane to another Dakota to Castel Bonito in Libya.
Yeah.
Spent 2 nights there. Then they put us in Liberator bombers, which have been converted. They've taken the bombing apparatus out and converted into sort of small troop carriers. It was an experiment because before we took off, the pilot came back and said, I'm not certain how with you blokes on the loading of this plane. He said, I want two of you to go out and sit in the tail, and after we've taken off, I'll tell you when to come back. So two very brave blokes volunteered and went and squatted up in the tail, and we duly took off. And I was the only one who could see out. There was a little tiny window, both sides, and I was watching. And it was a high plane, Liberators, of course, a high plane. And the wheel went up, I looked out this window, that one hadn't. Then I saw it go up, come down, go up, and I was giving a running commentary on this. And eventually the flight engineer came back with perspiration running down his face and looked out through the window. Anyway, I think they wound it up by hand, because eventually it went up quite slowly and went home. And then we turned for home. But then some pessimist said, oh, well, of course, when we get home and they lower that, it might lock and you'll collapse. And of course, we were in the, if we collapsed, we'd had it. So we sat there for 8 hours and landed at in an aerodrome, a perishing cold aerodrome. You can imagine 8th of January, 46, quite safely. Yeah. So off we went down to London. And as an Indian Army bloke, I was told to report to a reception area in Sloane Street. Went in there, and this bloke said, oh, you stay here tonight and then you report to the India office tomorrow. I said, correction, I'm going home tonight and I'll record. You can't do that. I said, well, I am. And I walked out and there was no sign of taxis. And then a bus came along, which I recognised. So I got on the bus and I changed to Clapham Junction, got another bus. The damn thing didn't stop. They changed all the routes and it didn't stop. Okay. And eventually, it was, I'd been up since 3 o'clock, I had all this kit, and when I got up I could hardly carry all this stuff, and a fella came along and said, can I help you? I said, thanks very much. And he picked up my kit and took me home. I reported to the India office the next day, my boss, the head of the division, and he said, oh, right, when can you start? This was, say, Wednesday or Thursday. Monday? I said, Monday? I've been away for 4.5 years. I'm due for 3 months leave. He said, you can't have 3 months leave. So we negotiated. I came back in a fortnight. The fringe benefit there was, of course, I got double. I was drawing a major rate of pay for 3 months. And so, so that was the end of my
End of your army career. That's probably, let's pause there.
Almost over five years service overseas. I don't want to blooming well go back again, you know. So I went and saw the establishment's people and they said, well, that's fair enough. Any more like you? I said, I think so. They said, well, you go away.
Oh,
crikey.
Oh, sorry. No.
It's come on.
Oh, all right.
I don't know. They said, well, you go off. I was the staff side. You go off and carry out a survey and let us know how many people want to go and stay and all the rest of it. So I did that, circulated the staff, got lists of blokes who wanted to go immediately, like me, people who thought they might like to go, and people who said they were prepared to stay on. Put the list in alphabetical order, so my name was near the top. And within 2 or 3 weeks, I got a message to report to the Ministry of Agriculture. So I spent most of my life then with the Ministry of Agriculture.
In England, yes.
In England, yes. So,
that's sad to see. Yeah, and then you retired and...
I retired in 1970. I've been retired for since 76.